Hey, everyone. Thanks for listening to DIY for Business. It's Russ and Greg with you. It feels so weird, Greg. I haven't seen you in forever, and it's only been like a week. But
I should be saying welcome back. You were on the road and doing some business. Tell everybody what you were doing.
I was. Yeah, it was great. We went to if you've listened to the show, you know I mentioned FileMaker, which is a database, a relational database. You build apps with it. You can do all kinds of crazy stuff. There's a whole show about it. And in fact, I think you called it Russ's Crazy FileMaker Show or something. But
like that, yeah.
But I went to they used to have this thing called DevCon, which they bring all these developers, and it's about 2,000 or so people. That stopped in pandemic days. Right. And they're trying to bring it back. So they started, a little smaller thing. We got to go to Austin. It was at the Apple campus because FileMaker is owned by Claris, which is an Apple company. And so I got to hang out at the Apple campus and see what that looked like, which was cool. I ate barbecue.
I know. I mean, there's so many questions I have for you. We could do a whole show just on your road trip here, but I'm curious. I've been to the Apple campus in the Bay Area. What is it like in Austin?
It's beautiful. Actually, they're building more. It's funny because you actually there's a bit of non-disclosure when you go to an Apple campus. Like you can't take certain photos and you can't do things, right? It's a beautiful campus. They did a great job in setting up this convention. It was over four floors. So we got to see various parts of the campus, and man, they do a great job at these places. Like the rooms, they have these giant TV things that the walls, the LG wall thing or whatever it is,
right,
for project, to do your slides on. So it just looks so cool. It's like, oh man, we had one of our bees, as we call them. A company's called Beeswax, so the team is bees. Andrew, he did a presentation, and just kind of getting in there and watching his presentation. I was man in the booth because, the marketing guy, right?
Right.
But watching him do his presentation, it just looks so much cooler on these big screens. The way that this thing is set up so nicely. And so it was a great showcase of the various talents around FileMaker, and the campus made everything look even better.
So did you produce all of the speakers from Beeswax?
We had one speaker from Beeswax this year, and we launched a beta product. We just did that from our booth, and we were doing some demos and whatnot. Mm-hmm. The coolest thing though is, now I'm going to get into a little story mode here, but with Beeswax back in 2011, I needed some help with our database, actually.
Right.
And so I downloaded this thing called Inspector Pro.
I remember that.
It's right. Yeah. And it goes way back when. This is 2011. So this is, we're pulling our memory banks here.
I see.
And then in 2018 or so, we actually used Beeswax and brought them on as a consultant for us to help us out. So I was a downloader. I was a client. Now I'm with the company. So fun little journey there. But Vince, the guy that creates Inspector Pro, the first guy I kind of nerded out when I met him the first time, and I felt like I was meeting a celebrity of some sort, right? He is a sort of a FileMaker celebrity, and now even more, he won the Lifetime Achievement Award, which was really cool. So it's exciting to kind of know somebody that is gone that far and done that much. And he's just such a nice guy, humble guy. I mean, basically, as his thank you thing, he's thanking the team and how cool it is that, he's got all these people to work with him. So it's such a cool thing to happen to just a cool person, and totally deserves it.
I'm curious, did they have any keynote speakers on how FileMaker helps in the finance side of a business?
Well, so they did a lot, there was a lot of different topics, right? And I always sort of, think about that a little bit, because I'm thinking about, the marketing side of things, right?
Right.
And, planning for this event and, budgeting everything from our dinners to, all the various things that we're doing, I'm thinking about what is our ROI on this event? What is the what is the number? And of course, you know, we could put together like all of those numbers in, inside a FileMaker. And yes, there were some people talking about the finance side, but, you know, as the marketing guy, I don't feel like I should be talking about it. I feel like we should have our guest maybe talk a little more about the finance side of things. We've got Kyle Smith joining us today. He's the CFO and co-founder of Strata Cloud, StrataCloudAccountants.com. Thank you for joining us, Kyle.
I'm excited to be here, Russ and Greg.
Yeah, so you heard my little our little intro there of getting into, you know, discovering ROI and figuring out like, oh, should we do this event again? Should we do more events like this? Questions like that. But let's, before we get into that, I'd love to have you kind of introduce yourself a little bit.
Sure. Well, first of all, I'm from Austin, Texas.
Oh, all right. Oh man. Okay. Well, we'll talk barbecue today too. I guarantee it.
Yes. That was on my mind because we're very passionate about that. Hopefully it lived up to expectations.
Yeah, I did Terry Black's.
Yeah.
It was amazing.
Yep.
It was, it was incredible. I tried to get into Franklin's. I couldn't, but just driving down the street, I had we had a rental car, and so I had the moonroof thing open, and I could smell it about three blocks away. I'm like, oh, I hope I can get in there, but the line was too long, so.
I mean, Kyle, Terry Black's was texting me pictures of all the barbecue he's eating, and I'm like, oh my gosh, how do I get on this trip next year?
It's unbelievable. I wasn't a huge barbecue guy, and then Terry Black's is amazing. I think that's the secret spot that you can still, you know, not have to wait 2 hours and
right
and get food. So, and it's beautiful there.
Yeah. Oh, the view from sitting on the porch, and just you've got all the downtown buildings like right in the background. It's amazing.
Yep. And I was one of those people that, hey, Franklin's is 3 hours. I was jaded. I'm not going to Franklin's ever. And then one time at a Super Bowl party, they had a freeze-dried brisket from Franklin's that they brought in. And I was like, this can't be, you know, it's freeze-dried, vacuum packed. I mean, it can't be good. And it might be one of the best briskets I've had. So it's Austin is fantastic barbecue scene.
Oh, yeah.
I'm glad you got to experience it.
Oh yeah, it was fantastic. I loved it. It was we did the little smoke room tour at Terry Black's as well, where we got to see and hear all of the, you know, and the funny thing is they're giving us all of the recipe. They're telling you everything that you need to do. You need to cook it for this long. You need to put this rub on it. You need to spray it with this. You need to, you know, check on it this time, and you need to wrap it at this time. And they're telling us everything. And so one of my coworkers was like, you just gave us all the secrets. And he's like, I gave you this, the recipe. I didn't give you the skill.
Yeah.
Skill takes a long time, you know? Yep. So I thought that was a great line. Actually, that's kind of a nice line too of about finance, right? That was always my scary thing. When running my business, you don't know what you're doing. You're jumping into this. I don't know how many times Greg and I have said that, where you start your business and like nobody trains you on management. Nobody trains you on leadership. Doing something new and you're jumping out there. The finance part though can be particularly scary because, you know, those three letters, the IRS. So it gets pretty scary. And also planning for getting everything right. Budgeting, it can get pretty difficult, and kind of, you know, you're bringing the skill,
yeah,
that those guys at the barbecue are bringing. So at what point do you think somebody needs to engage services like yours? Is it early on, or is it midway? Is it late stage? Like when are they bringing you on?
Yeah, no, it's a great question, and it depends on a couple of things. I'll say first, it doesn't matter who you are, the size of the business, you have to have the CFO function in your business. So, you know, if that's you, because you're just starting out, you've got to have it. And the reason is because if you're not, you're leaving most of your decisions up to your gut and chance. And those can be right, but they also can be wrong. And when they're wrong, you're compounding things from the start of your business on every month that you don't address it. Right. So we've seen cases where it's a $10,000 a month mistake that's multiplied over 3 years. And now you've got a $300,000, not a mistake, but money that's left on the table month over month over month. So the CFO function, And we talk about that all the time. I talk about that all the time, how you can get started doing that as a business owner. If you don't have a fractional CFO or a CFO, you're not ready yet. It has to happen. So that's one. But two, if you are going to bring on a fractional CFO, it depends on how fast you're growing. So if you're going from zero to 30 employees in like 18 months, which is a business that we've worked with recently, we needed to get started right away with them, because all the mistakes that you might make, like on the personnel side, just building up an admin team that's big enough to support a business that's growing that fast, right, you're going to want to start doing the forward-looking analysis, which is what we do, the budgeting and forecasting, like you said, Russ. You want to do that at the beginning rather than 18 months in and your business is cranking, and then you find out that you're actually making negative gross profit, which is something that we've seen before, where a business is actually not selling at a high enough price to even justify the cost, the direct costs of what they're doing, let alone you know, the salaries and all the other overheads that they're doing. So if you're growing quickly, I would recommend engaging a CFO early on. The ROI is just, it can be hundreds of times what, you know, what our services would be, for instance, or anybody else that you would get that can have that expert insight. So otherwise, you know, a lot of businesses and kind of hitting that million of yearly revenue plus, and you're not ready to go to a full-time CFO because it can be pretty cost prohibitive, that's a good starting range all the way up. And we work with companies that maybe could afford an in-house CFO, but what we're providing is very valuable because we're targeted. So a fractional CFO service can go pretty wide, but usually maybe that million mark plus. But like I said, it depends on how fast you're growing.
Talk a little bit about a fractional CFO and the type of width that you have as a fractional CFO, because, you know, what is the difference between a fractional CFO and just having a full-time CFO on staff and part of the team working in the building, as they say, even though everything's kind of remote now, but, you know, working in the building on a, you know, daily basis. What are the differences and why is one better than the other in certain situations?
So a fractional CFO can do everything that an in-house CFO can do from like a services perspective. So if we're talking like vendor negotiations, the budgeting and forecasting, holding the business accountable, really at a high level is what a CFO is doing. All of those can be done. The advantage of an in-house CFO is if you've got those sort of activities get amplified, the bigger you get. So, if you were going to bring on our company or hire me as a fractional CFO and you were $100 million company, I would be spending, you know, my entire time probably dedicated to you, because that's the amount of time that we would need to, you know, bounce ideas off each other, talk strategy, forecast, look at departments, look at procurement. So it's really a time function in terms of what a fractional CFO can do versus a regular CFO. And then it comes down to expertise, obviously. So then it just depends on who you're working with.
So having an in-house CEO or a CFO, you've got somebody like kind of on that leadership team. Does a lot of what you're doing, are you kind of jumping into that leadership team as well? In general, yeah. I'm sure it's, you know, situational, but are you generally jumping onto that leadership team?
Yes, exactly. That's the whole idea, is that we provide that leadership function if you're not ready for somebody that's full-time in-house. So I work with clients where I'm wearing many hats, as you know, we're usually working with small and medium-sized businesses. So I might be kind of managing their accounting department. At the same time, I'm on executive meetings, you know, a few times a month or more, making sure that our strategy is aligned, making recommendations on tech stack. As we're growing, you know, kind of going into y'all space, but all of that same thing, acting as the CFO is what we do as fractional CFOs. It's just that that business may not need someone that's dedicated 40 hours a week or 50 or 60 or whatever it might be. All the same services we can do. there can be potential drawbacks the bigger you get. That's why we're really looking that we're the bridge between you're the CFO function and you need somebody. We're the bridge between the full-time person and it's just me as the business owner, for instance.
Yeah. You know, as the CEO of my company, you know, I'm dealing with the finance department and I'm you know, Russ knows we're looking at, I don't know, 500 different line items of numbers to determine whether we're, you know, going in the right direction, what, you know, what's not going the right direction, what needs to be fixed, all of those types of things.
Yeah.
And ultimately it kind of comes down to some major metrics, right? You know, there's some things that really should be looked at on a more constant basis and not just lose, you know, in the forest, right? You lose it in all the minutia of all the other numbers. There's probably some main ones that need to be looked at on an ongoing basis. What is your recommendation of some of the metrics that are, you know, those key ones to look at?
Yeah, a great point. So a lot of the time I find even larger businesses, people get eyes gloss over or they get kind of overwhelmed.
Definitely.
Yeah, they get overwhelmed when they start talking KPIs and numbers because there's hundreds of KPIs, you know, by industry that you can look at. And a lot of them are super valuable. But I like to take a step back, especially, you know, when we're talking with the executive team and focus on really the top five, and they all come from the profit and loss statement. And when I usually talk with people, they're at least familiar with the profit and loss statement and know what it is so they can kind of picture it in their head. They've got all the revenue at the top, and then you got all your expenses, and then net income at the bottom. Did you make money or you lose money? So if we start with that frame, the ones that we really like to look at and I really preach are revenue, gross profit percentage, net income percentage, and net cash flow. And those are all very easily explainable where people can kind of say, hey, I can understand that as someone who's not staring at numbers 8 hours a day like I am, and still feel comfortable. And if you know those numbers and know how to explain those numbers on a month-to-month basis in your business, biggest company down to sole proprietor, you can get a good sense of how the business is doing. A really interesting example of that, if y'all are interested, just happened a couple months ago. We had a client come on, they were looking to get a bank loan, and their bank balance, their cash balance in their bank was pretty steady, I'd say. They weren't worried about cash from a month-to-month basis, and they thought they were doing pretty well. They wanted to expand a location in this case, so they went to the bank to get a loan. The bank came back and said, we're not interested in loaning you money. Y'all are losing money, and your payables balance is growing every month. And they were a little bit shocked when they heard that, because, hey, we see money in the bank every month. And that's kind of as far as they got on the financial side. If they had looked at the metrics that I was talking about, just those high level metrics, they would have seen that their net income number was probably negative, and that their net cash flow number, it's just one number on the net cash cash flow sheet. So you don't need to understand a cash flow sheet. If you can just look at your net cash and look at your net income, and they would have seen a discrepancy there. And the reason was, the reason why is they weren't making money as a business from month to month, but they weren't paying their vendors out either. So their cash balance was staying pretty consistent because they were growing the amount that they owed their vendors. They thought they were doing okay. The bank had to point out to them that they were not doing okay. If they'd had looked at that earlier, they could have addressed it and maybe expanded earlier, kept growing earlier. So it's like I said at the beginning, it's really important to look at the numbers earlier than later. Even if you don't know the answer, you can start asking questions and then dig into more of why. And then you can start looking at all those other detailed KPIs that exist for particular industries and go from there. But you've got to start with those top five.
I wanted to jump back to something you said earlier. You started talking about pricing. You're not charging enough. You're setting your price too low, perhaps. That is something where I've probably, funny enough, you know, like we scheduled this interview a few weeks ago or, you know, whatever it was. And between scheduling it and now, I've probably talked to three different business owners about pricing and how difficult it can be sometimes to figure out like what your pricing should be. You know, there's looking at competitors, there's looking at, of course, cost and things like that. But can you, is there any like good recipe for figuring out pricing? Like, or what's the best recipe, I guess? I mean, I know there's recipes out there or ideas out there, but what's a good recipe that somebody, if they're trying to, you know, figure that out right now, what's a good take home for them right now?
So if the question is there a good, a perfect recipe? So first answer, no.
Right.
that really is a huge struggle. There's not a magic bullet. There's not a magic answer. And that's why I say you need to look, because it's about incrementally improving the business. We can't come in and say, here's where you should price, because there's so many factors involved, like you said, and those factors are changing from month to month.
Right.
So really what I prescribe is look at the business, look at the financials, and then look at what you know from an industry perspective, and you've got to put all those pieces together. So the way you explained it, Russ, is really what you need to do and add to that is put the financials in there, put everything together. So, you know, as an example, you might see, or we might see that margin is probably too low based on the industry benchmark. So then you can look and say, all right, maybe our price is too low, but maybe you're doing a ton of volume and you're kind of niched as, you know, getting a price advantage with your customers, and they're coming to you from other places. And so you're doing volume enough that you're overcoming that price being too low in terms of the industry. You're making more gross profit in terms of dollars because you're getting more customers. So there's not like a simple answer to it all the time, but always ask the question. And in that case, one of the important ones, like I said in the beginning, is are you priced enough to where you're actually making a gross profit that's positive? Because mm-hmm. we've been in contact with businesses where that hasn't been the case. And there might be a good reason for that. If you're trying to gain a ton of market share early and you're kind of know what you're planning to do, that could make sense. So I would want to say that there's a perfect answer, but it really is what's the answer for what you're trying to achieve in the business. And don't ignore it. That's what right. I'd say, don't ignore it.
Right. Yeah. I did a price increase one time when I was running my business, and I did a fairly drastic price increase because, you know, supplies were expensive. Like, you know, insurance was, you know, like went up drastically. I was in the like entertainment business, and there was some incident that happened at a concert that, you know, not related to me, but even on the other side of the country, there was a fire, and all of a sudden insurance for every kind of event went up like drastically.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I'm trying to figure out my next year, and I'm like, I got to raise my prices. And do I want to raise it incrementally over time, or do I just want to do a big jump once? I opted for the big jump once. I will say for me in that particular situation, it worked out fantastic. I actually, you know, I saw a big jump in net cash flow. Fantastic. Great. This is, you know, this is a win for me. Coincidentally, like a, you know, within like a year, some of the supply that I was having to purchase went down in cost. You know, technology gets better over time, so actually the cost went down on certain things. So it was kind of like this huge win. But I've always wondered, is that the way to go? Is that the best way to go? Is it a big jump once, or is it like you want to kind of ease your way into cost change or price changes?
That's a great question, and maybe geeking out a little bit, but it really has to do with your operational leverage.
Okay.
Are y'all familiar with the concept?
Well, let's go ahead and say what it is.
In your example, if you did that and you have a ton of fixed costs, meaning costs that were independent of your sales level. So I think like your salary, for instance, if you had a space that you were renting, it doesn't matter how much you're selling, those costs are going to be the same. If you have a large percentage of those costs compared to costs that are fixed, and you make a price jump and you don't see the volume going away, the volume stays consistent, you're going to gain massively compared to if you have a lot of costs that are dependent on your sales level. So in that case, I would say take the risk and do what you did. Go for that big one jump, because if it works, your profitability is going to go through the roof. at that mm-hmm. point, because your cost levels aren't going to change and you're taking the risk that people are going to kind of accept that higher price. And so your profit percentage as a percentage of sales would go up and your dollars would go up. And I'd say take that risk. Conversely, if you had a ton of variable costs, meaning costs that were dependent on sales, it might be a tougher question, because at that point your upside is not as big, because mm-hmm. most of your sales are dependent on, or most of your costs are dependent on the sale itself. So if you sell a bunch more, for instance, or you sell a lot less because you raise price, it could make a bigger difference. So it depends on your cost structure as one factor. But I would say what you did is probably what I would recommend in that case, if your structure was set where you had a lot of costs that weren't dependent on the sale that you were doing.
Gotcha.
So since COVID, I have seen food prices at restaurants continually just keep climbing, talking about, the pricing. And I've also seen a ton of restaurants close. Right. Yep. Since COVID, they just did not survive it. I don't know whether it's because they tried to raise their prices and they lost their customers or another reason. But I keep seeing more and more restaurants raise their price. Like, Russ and I always joke that we always make our best decisions over a burrito. Well, a burrito, used to cost a certain amount. Well, I swear I'm paying double for that same burrito today that I used to with Russ a couple of years ago. I know the cost of that burrito has not doubled in producing, right? I mean, there's, beans have not gone up that much. Tortillas have not gone up that much. But these restaurants keep raising. Are they just trying to find the ceiling of what they can actually charge and keep the doors open and make the profit they're looking for? Or, what's driving that?
Yeah, so I'm a bit of an insider on this because we definitely work with some restaurant groups. I can get behind the curtain a little bit. So the first thing I'll say, it is a little unfair, Greg, that you would say that not all costs have gone up. We know.
Oh, no, I believe costs have gone up. Since,
but not, you're saying not double.
Okay.
Yeah, so you're saying that, maybe not, you're right. I'm just saying there are some cases, like last year there was a lime shortage where lime prices went up fourfold. So if you're selling margaritas, you might have to adjust your price, or you could be quickly losing money under that scenario. So there was some supply shocks that forced restaurants to make some moves. But on the whole, I agree with you, it's probably not double, and then in most cases, and prices are doubling. So assuming that, are they looking for the ceiling? I would say yes. It's mostly a pricing strategy, and they're kind of seeing where that is, because the margin is usually so low at the restaurant anyways. You constantly have to be looking for where that ceiling is. That said, that's not the only strategy. I know of a restaurant group that basically they have I think it's a burrito. It's either that or a breakfast taco that they offer at cost. So it's like four tacos for $4 or something like that. And it's just that one menu item. And the idea is that gets people in the door, and then they can price the rest of their stuff regularly. So yes, that's definitely a strategy.
Right?
Yeah. So you have multiple strategies to use, but the end game is they are trying to look for that kind of sweet spot.
So is that what you're doing, when you're working with your clients? Are you bringing in those optional strategies and then you guys are working it out and figuring out which is the best way to go?
Yeah, that's definitely a big part of it. So a lot of those discussions, like that lime shortage problem, we were obviously, you can't foresee that, and it was pretty I mean, you can foresee it, but you wouldn't know that kind of price difference. When we were looking at the numbers, we saw a massive decrease in their gross profit from 1 month to the next, and had to dig into their recipes, and then found out that here's the levers we can pull. The lever you can pull is you got to find either a price replacement on the cost side, or you got to adjust your price. And in that case, they adjusted price and they found a replacement that didn't affect the quality. Either way, they weren't able to fully gain back the amount that they lost because of that shortage. So you are kind of at the mercy of the supplier in some cases. I know it makes you mad, Greg, to probably hear that with the double the burrito, but the truth. But yes, so that's a lot of what we're doing, is trying to identify those things. And then what levers can we pull so they can get a margin that is going to sustain the business?
I listened to some of what you said, Kyle, but you said breakfast tacos, and that is the one thing I missed in Austin. So sorry, I was thinking about that a little bit. Those are so good.
Well, now that burritos have gone up so much and I don't eat as many of them because, you know, it's just costly, yeah, right? I just don't feel as smart anymore, Russ.
Okay, so you did say, though, that that's where we would go for ideas. And, you know, the ideas cost money. You know, like if Greg decides to open up, I don't know, some pickleball palace because he loves pickleball.
Right.
He's got this amazing idea.
Yeah.
He doesn't have a business for it yet. But like, do you jump in on things like that, too? And whether it's a new business, like just starting up, or it's, you know, and just this idea. Or let's say, you know, Greg's got an existing pickleball company and he wants to expand out into these things. Are you jumping into that stuff too? Because that would be extremely helpful.
That's one of my favorite things to do. And awesome. It's hard to convince people that, you need a CFO, like I said, right now, because they're pre-revenue. So it might be on me and our company to figure out better ways to kind of work with that, because, you know, cost is always a consideration. That early on, it's tough. But so short answer is yes, I'd love to. We just need to be better at finding opportunities, I think, because it is super, I know it's super useful as a business owner down the line. It's like I said, we've had times where we've talked about how to finance a business early on, and they might have had the means to where they could self-finance with a line of credit or something else like that. And they grew the business from there to where, 5 years down the line, they've kept millions, literally millions of dollars in the business, because they've self-financed it instead of taking on investors. And if we hadn't done the analysis at the beginning, they might've just assumed, hey, I'm going to do 50-50 and take 50% investors. And sometimes that's a great idea, but sometimes you don't have to do that. And if the business is a success, you're just giving away half of the company in that case. So that stuff gets me really excited. I'd love to do more of that early stage stuff. Oh, and by okay. the way, just to go back really quick, a rec for you guys, next time you're in Austin, there's a place that is the best of both worlds. I'm not affiliated with them in any way.
Grabbing
it's called Ballantina's.
Oh, that okay. So that was on my list. I wanted to go there. The place looks amazing. It's a food truck, right?
Yes. Well that's the beauty of it. It's a food truck, but it's a slow smoke barbecue place all in one. So they have barbecue. They also make their own tortillas. And so the menu item that I like the best is called the Real Deal Holyfield. It's a breakfast taco with a huge slab of slow smoked brisket and a fried egg. And the brisket is as good as anything that you'll get in Austin. And they're amazing. And like I said, I'm not affiliated. I'm not gaining in any way. It's just, they are amazing. I recommend, because you get a breakfast taco and barbecue at the same time.
So here's the funny thing about this. Like I was actually, my daughter's birthday was recently, and I was like, well, what do you want for dinner? And so she wanted burritos. And so, I was like researching Austin that day to try to figure out where I should go. So while I was waiting for the burritos to be made, I was actually learning about Valentina's. So this totally ties in. Yeah,
well, that's see, I think amazing. We have a business model, Russ, Kyle. I think we got a pickleball facility that serves breakfast burritos and, you know, smoked barbecue, right? I think that's the perfect blend, right? I think we got the model.
Well, let's run the numbers.
Let's just run the numbers. So speaking of running the numbers, right? Russ started kind of this whole thing was like, you know, should we do this event again? What's the ROI on doing the event that he just did in Austin? And I come from, you know, more of the sales side of the business as a CEO and more in the marketing side of the business than the finance side. And there's always seems like there's this tension between the finance side and the sales and marketing side. Like, oh no, you guys shouldn't spend on that. We don't really see the ROI on that. Yeah. And, you know, I've been like a CEO of different businesses for like over, you know, close to 30 years now. And there's always that tension. And I'm going, why is there this tension? Because aren't we talking about the profitability of the company and just evaluating where the money should go? But finance side always wants to like hold the purse strings. Don't spend, like spend as little as possible. Like, where do you fall in this whole debate and philosophy?
Yeah, this one's near and dear to me because I'm the penny pincher.
Yeah.
I'm the CFO guy at heart. And that's what, you know, when I'm coming in with other businesses, holding them accountable. So I think that's why that's the attitude, Greg, where we're coming from is we have to hold them accountable. You guys are just spending money like crazy and we've got to rein in and make sure that, you know, the business can survive. It's always, you know, threat level critical red for us. And we're trying to make the business survive. So that's where we're always coming from. And that's what I'm always telling businesses. That said, when we started our business, Strata Cloud, my partner, he's the sales guy, marketing guy. And I've learned from him, you know, you can't, everything has an ROI. Sometimes it's long-term. It's not as easy on the sales side to say if something worked or didn't work. So I've tried to be a lot more, my point is I've tried to be a lot more open to marketing spend, sales activities, because it's not, you know, it's not as easy when you're doing it yourself, like we are at Strata growing the business. It takes a lot of work on that side and you have to devote dollars to that side. So I can see where you're coming from on the CEO side and building the business side. I'm not good at it yet. I'm not a sales guru by any means, but I can see where y'all are coming from. And I still, I'm still responsible for the cash. So I'm still making sure that we're not getting too crazy. But yeah, I'm kind of in between, I guess. And I started on the CFO side. I'm moving towards seeing the perspective of the CEO and the CMO.
You know, so now I'll throw out a marketing question about, you know, attribution of like money spend. So that can be somewhat difficult nowadays, right? So I've been doing, I don't know, Google ads. I was a beta tester way back when. And, you know, they're sort of the bottom of the funnel, right? Because everybody, you know, like you could have a banner on some website and then, you know, driving down the freeway, you could have a big billboard and people have heard about your company several times during the day. Right. Maybe they got to, you even do some print, you know, mailing or something, but then Google gets the attribution. So when you're looking at those types of numbers, how do you figure out okay, well, there's a certain branding element to this and that, you know, sometimes it's tough to sell a business on, you know, I mean, I've definitely been there, talking to business owners about, you know, well, we're going to spend this much money. Well, how many leads am I going to get? You're not probably going to get any. It's, you know, it's going to be, it's a branding campaign. So it's not a call to action. How do you do that? Like, what's your recipe for that? And how do you talk to business owners about that part of it?
Yeah, pretty much a lot, like you said. So you have the two marketing functions. And like I said, these are things that I'm soaking in and trying to learn, but it's the two marketing functions. You have brand building and then direct outreach, which maybe is easier to measure, is more of a straight numbers game where it's easier to measure like the leads from outbounding and all that. But what I say in the brand building side is this is an ROI and we need to budget it maybe based on industry data prior experience. So, you know, we had a company that the industry data said spend 5%. They were consistently double that in terms of their brand building spend. And they let it work. So it's a hard answer because it's not a straight numbers answer of, hey, you put in 10% of your marketing budget this month and, here's the revenue to show for it. It just doesn't work like that. So really, I think what it is checking in on it, you know, once a month, maybe once a quarter, and kind of adjusting based on, you know, how the business is doing and, you know, how they're feeling about it as an executive team or as an owner. But it's really hard. The short answer is you have to believe in it and believe in the person that you're working with that that it's going to work in the long term.
Right.
I got one last question. And, you know, you mentioned industry data. You know, obviously most companies, well, privately held companies, their financials are private, right? So you don't get to see it. Like, where are you actually pulling this, you know, data history to base these decisions on. And I'll even loop it back into this, you know, crazy idea of us opening up a pickleball company together. You know, pickleball is so new, there's not a lot of data out there for pickleball facilities because they're, you know, they're just starting to pop up across the country. Like, where do you find this data to help us make these decisions? We're going to start a company, right? The three of us. I think it's on record right now. We're recording. So, you know, how are we going to get this data?
So that's how it works. That's how you get the
that's how we do discount. It. Yeah, that's how we do it.
I knew you were angling for something.
Burritos, pickleball, barbecue. There we go.
Yeah, no, I can't complain, really. Well, the short answer is we have a service that we subscribe to where we get all of our benchmarking data, and it's just a lot more robust than like free sources. But for free source, you can use like BLS data, the Bureau of Labor Statistics. They have a decent kind of database. It's just harder to manage, and I find it harder to see, am I looking at the right thing? So we have a subscription that kind of, and I can, we can connect that. I can put the link of what we use. So that's one. And the other thing I was going to say, that's just one piece of the pie. So, you know, when you're in a new industry, the benchmarking data is worth less. And even if the benchmarking data is really relevant, it's still just one piece of the puzzle. So that's what I would say in our business that we're going to start together. The benchmarking data would be less relevant, and it's more the idea, which is solid gold. I mean, we're gonna go to the moon.
We're gonna crush it. Yeah, for sure.
I love it. We'll go to Valentina's to discuss everything, and then we know the ideas are going to be the best.
Absolutely. It's perfect.
That's right. All right. So, well, we figured out a unique way of working with you, Kyle. We just pitched it on the show, and we've got it set up. If somebody listening wants to work with you, how do they do so?
Yeah. So our website is stratacloudaccountants.com, and listeners to DIY, we have a landing page that's stratacloudaccountants.com/DIY. And in there, we've got exclusive free download where you can download an Excel. It's super straightforward, but it's basically the five KPI metrics that I talked about. And I explain, you know, how you can do it in less than 30 minutes a month if you're a business owner, no matter the size, getting started on the financials, tracking it in that Excel file, along with a couple other resources. And we have other free resources on the website. So I'm definitely passionate about teaching and offering that to people. So excited to do that. Cool. So yeah, like I said, stratacloudaccountants.com, and then stratacloudaccountants.com/DIY for the downloadable content.
That's awesome. Content. We'll make sure to share that with everyone. We'll put a link in the description and, you know, throw it on our LinkedIn and stuff like that, so the people can find you and reach out to you. I think it's so important to do this, and you know, only because I didn't do it. You know, it's like, I feel like I should have brought somebody in a little bit sooner than I did. I did eventually, but, I was probably 3 years too late, and I probably would have had a full head of hair had I brought somebody in a little sooner. Cause it's stressful, you know? So, it's great that, a service like yours is out there to help folks. So thank you so much.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Kyle.
Yeah, thanks for joining us. And thank you for listening, subscribing, and reviewing DIY for Business. You know, when you're doing the reviewing thing, we technically can't tell you how many stars, right? Like, Greg, like we can't say how many stars to put on there, but
no, but you know, we will high five you.
We could high five. Yeah, if you give us stars, we'll give you a high five. There you go. Yeah. But yeah, be sure to subscribe. You know, we've had a nice little bump in listeners over the last couple of months here. And I think part of that is that we hit 100 episodes a couple of episodes ago. So that's really exciting. We're doing this for like 2.5 years. I talked to, you know, Kyle, as you're walking around Austin, you're probably going to see some people because I was bringing up the show a bunch as I was as I was walking around exploring the beautiful city of Austin. So if, you know, like Kyle, you know, he's got this great business and he wanted to tell others about it. This is like a great source for you to do so. If you would like to join us as a guest, just head over to DIYforbusiness.com and there's a little form there. You can fill it out. You can also see all of our past episodes, get a link over to our YouTube, get a link over to our various podcasting platforms to listen. I will also note that if you were listening on Google Podcasts, hey, that went away. So go head over to YouTube, listen to us there. You're probably still, it's still working for a little bit. So make sure you head over to YouTube and hit subscribe over there. Thank you for listening. Thank you for subscribing. Thank you for reviewing us. We are Russ and Greg from DIY for Business, where you are not alone.